Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Why It Matters. I'm Tracy Kronzak, Director of Innovation at Now It Matters, joined as always by my co-host, Tim.
Hi, Tracy.
Hey, Tim. Morning. I'm following up on a joke that came up in our pre-show and just saying I decided to wear my Jedi outfit today.
I was just going to ask. Are you going to your Jedi Jedi school after
this? I am. Friday is Jedi Day out here. Yeah, right. So we are, well,
that's great.
You know,
that's good.
All the lightsabers and the Force stuff, you know.
Don't forget your tricorder.
No. Those don't exist in Jedi world. It's just all mind tricks and nothing else.
I just wanted to cross the dots on that.
Nerds. Anyhow, I am super excited to let our guest introduce himself today. As a point of reference, I have been kind of a fan of our guest Sam's work over the past year and a half in particular, largely because Sam seems to demonstrate the same propensity I do in public spaces, and that is to actually say what he's thinking. And about the fourth or fifth time after Sam said what he thought in a very public forum about what was going on, I was like, I need to know Sam more. So I hope all of our listeners feel the same way. And Sam, why don't you introduce yourself?
Thanks, Tracy and Tim. I hope your listeners aren't saying I need to know Sam less at this So, well, I'm Sam Kaplan, and super excited to join you guys for the podcast today. So I guess in terms of an introduction, I've been engaged in the on the technology side of the grant-making space for many years. I currently work for an amazing software company called Submittable, and I am the Vice President of Social Impact, which is a very, very fancy title, but I have the opportunity to spend lots of time like doing things like this and, you know, evangelizing what we're doing at the company and getting to influence the product team a little bit and putting lots of content out with the marketing team. It's kind of a dream come true. Like, you know, I spend a lot of time on social media, just putting thoughts out into the world to see where they go. And finally, I had an organization say, like, why don't you come do that for us? And we'll even pay you to do it. So it's my dream job and I totally love it. Before that, I had a couple other pretty amazing roles in philanthropy as well. I was the chief information officer for the Walton Family Foundation here in Bentonville, Arkansas, which is where I live. Prior to that, I was in a similar role as the head of technology and data analytics at the Walmart Foundation. So cornered the market on philanthropy here in Northwest Arkansas.
That's great. Sam, we wanted to ask you, what changes do you see in philanthropy since the pandemic?
It's a great question. It's almost like what hasn't changed in philanthropy since the global pandemic. So
ouch, but true. Yeah,
I know. Well, I mean, I think you know, I hate that it took a global pandemic to you know, start to see some of the changes that have happened out there. But you know, when I think about philanthropy, like, I think that there was very little change from like the beginning of time up through the end of 2019. And then, you know, 2020 came and everybody knows what happened. Like, there was a global pandemic and there was the murder of George Floyd and the corresponding rise of the Black Lives Matter movement. And there was a super contentious election and we're in this extremely divisive political environment. And like all of these things really came together and they conspired against nonprofits in a lot of ways, right? So nonprofits weren't able to get out and do their fundraising like they normally do. And what resulted was that they finally collectively like raised their hand and they said to their funders, we need some serious help here, right? And they laid it out. They said, the way that you require us to like apply for grants is too burdensome. We have to come back into the system multiple times. You know, you're dictating the terms of engagement, right? You have all the power in the relationship. You know, you tell us exactly how we get to spend the money and you tell us the sort of impact that we have to make and how we have to measure that impact. And it's just so hard for nonprofits to actually get out there and, you know, focus on their own mission when they have so many contingencies and so much work that they have to do related to like the funding of the projects. And so I think that they collectively raised their hands and they voiced these concerns. And, you know, to the credit of grant makers, they responded. And so we saw all of these like sort of movements start to emerge. Like, they weren't necessarily new, but all these events of last year really helped things like trust-based philanthropy and participatory grant making and streamlined grant making really kind of like, you know, get a lot more traction. And these things started to change the relationship and the power structure between funders and nonprofits. And so now I think people like me are like looking back over the last 18 months and we're really trying to like put all the pieces together and figure out how do we start to like operationalize all of this and accelerate all of this with technology. So I think that to me is the biggest change that has happened in philanthropy in like the last 30 years or so.
There's lots to unpick, and I'm glad we've got a lot of time to unpick it, but I would love to hear, because I've seen the hashtag a lot, but I don't know what is meant by trust-based philanthropy. Do you mind unpacking that a little bit?
Yeah. So, you know, I would encourage everyone listening to Google the Trust-Based Philanthropy Project. They have a great website. You know, they have like, I think it's five or six sort of principles that they lay out that define what trust-based philanthropy is. But essentially, it's an attempt to shift that power imbalance. So I mentioned that, you know, that in the traditional grant maker and nonprofit relationship, the grant maker holds all the cards because they're the ones that are, you know, giving away the dollars, right? And so they get to dictate the terms of engagement, so to speak. And it's been super detrimental and really hard for nonprofits to achieve their mission because they have been so sort of strongly influenced by grant makers. And so I think sort of the core idea behind trust-based philanthropy is that it's advocating to share that power more and to put more power back into the hands of nonprofit organizations and enable them to go out and do their work sort of, you know, as they see fit without being so influenced by what the grant maker feels is most important. And so, you know, it's advocating for things like more general operating grants so that nonprofits can figure out how to spend the money in whatever way they see fit. And it's advocating for reducing grantee burden, meaning like, let's start simplifying our grant applications and our progress reports. And let's really like figure out how to, I think most importantly, develop more of a strategic partnership between funders and nonprofit organizations.
That is astounding. And again, like Tim said, there's so much to unpick in everything you said, because part of what you're really talking about, in my opinion, is applying the principles of equity and justice to grant making and yes, doing all the things that the Black Lives Matter movement talk about. And that is, let's stop pretending that what we have is a just society to begin with. And therefore, when we unpick these relationships, let's also unpick how they uphold all the systemic biases that are inherent to our society in the first place. And, you know, I just want to say to our listeners, like, Sam came up on my radar screen because Sam's one of those people that when I've been in online forums and so forth is one of those people that makes me feel like less of a crazy person for the stuff that I'm saying and feeling. And, you know, the follow-ups I have are things that I feel like I've been trying to say myself, but you have much better language for, and I appreciate that. And that is, we have had a couple of endeavors come by in the past year. One is you were part of Chantal Forster, who is also a guest on this podcast, her Honeycomb endeavor. And also, I know that you are connected to tech platforms in your role now. And both of and one of the folks we also had as a recent guest is Adam Rosenzweig from Okta. Adam put forth this idea that philanthropy needs to change because technology is changing nonprofits. And let's stop thinking about it as a single sort of vending machine transaction and start thinking about it as a subscription philosophy. And Chantal put forth the idea that the only way that nonprofits are going to succeed in the 21st century is if we really unpick funding their digital infrastructure and their capacity. I would love to hear your perspectives on those concepts.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, first off, I'm so happy that you you gave a shout out to Chantal and to TAG, the Technology Association of Grantmakers. It's been an organization I've had the privilege of being involved with for many years, you know, as a member and then a member of the board of directors, and now a member again, now that I'm working for a tech company. So over the course of 2020, TAG had created a task force for digital infrastructure. And the idea was to really explore that honeycomb model and to start figuring out like why does philanthropy not fund technology for nonprofits to the level that we need to be doing, right? And so it was pretty amazing to see like so many grant makers as part of this task force that, you know, that stepped back and said, of course we should be doing this. Like, why don't we, you know? And again, it kind of goes back to this idea that, you know, pre-2020 philanthropy, you know, was just super guilty of doing things because they had always done things a certain way, right? And so technology was usually accounted for as like a small fraction of the budget when it came to a grant. And we rarely saw grant makers make, you know, wholesale technology grants or these like general operating grants where if a nonprofit feels like spending the entire grant on their digital infrastructure, they're free to do so. And so again, hopefully like all of this change and evolution that we saw over the course of last year will also equate back to nonprofits receiving more funding to be able to bolster their technology. And like, I would go so far as to say, like, I don't want us to think about this just in terms of like, do I have the laptops that I need? Or do I have like the software that I need, you know, to do all of this back office work? Like nonprofits need to collectively come together and say, we need technology to innovate. Like we want to be on the forefront of all of this emerging technology that's out there, like, you know, artificial intelligence and blockchain and crypto and decentralized finance. Like these are all things that can really make, you know, these like sea changes in society. And nonprofits have got to quickly like take care of that digital infrastructure and make sure that they have the laptops and then immediately move on to innovation. And hopefully grant makers now are starting to come to the table to give them the funding to do that work.
Sam, I know I love what you're talking about there. And I want to say one thing I want to say is as an economist, I don't think there are any bad actors in this space. So in the work that we've been doing over the last couple of years, it's put us in touch with a lot of the players at the ecosystem level. So philanthropy platforms, you know, the last mile is service providers and nonprofits, you know, and there are large market forces at work here that have created kind of the conditions that we live in. But I don't think any of that, I think all of the intentions have actually been around impact, making a difference. I want to go on record saying that. I think that that's important. I also feel like all of us are recognizing like there have been issues with all of that. When we talk about innovation, I'm so glad you raised that, because you're one of those people that for me keeps moving like the horizon line on what's possible. So, you know, I watch you on LinkedIn and you bring up these ideas like the metaverse, and I'm like, yeah, what is that? And so then I'm like, I'm trying to contribute, and I've got nothing to say. This is fascinating watching you and Tim Sarantonio like do your thing around that. And I love that. I think that's great. And so my next comment is not against that, it is with that, but to say, sometimes I imagine, you know, there being this race car of nonprofits driving towards impact, and that there's a finish line of, you know, digital transformation, and innovation just keeps moving that finish line. And behind that race car, there's an enormous parachute called digital competency that we just don't know how to get at, which is just the fundamentals of using technology as a team, as an organization, and making decisions around technology at a, you know, at an organizational level. So at Now It Matters, we call that the human stack. You know, the tech stack is all of the other work. And so we do a lot of work around how do we architect the human stack with the same level of attention that we've given the tech stack. Does that model hold for you? Am I seeing something wrong there? Is that offensive? Which I hope I don't mean for it to be.
No, not in the least. I mean, to me, you know, it definitely starts with people and like digital competencies. And I don't know. I really don't know what the answer is. Like, if I kind of look at my own generation, even like the generation that came after me, like, you know, we didn't really focus on technology as like a force for innovation. Like, you know, like for me, like growing up, like with my career, I focused on like, well, how do I manage a project better? I wasn't necessarily thinking about like, how do I use technology to make the world a better place? I can tell you it's like super different right now for like Gen Z. Like I have a son who's about to turn 18. He's, you know, obviously like he and all of his friends have grown up with technology. They grow up, you know, learning how to write code. And they're a very, very like digital first generation. And so they're also super interested in changing the world, right? Like it's extremely important to Gen Z, if I can make a very broad generalization there. And so, you know, for me, like the hope is, I don't know that I'm getting my colleagues out there, like, you know, like you and I and Tracy, and probably a lot of the people listening to us are like, yeah, innovation, technology, we love it, right? But like, there's so many out there that are still focused on, how do I make my project a little bit more efficient? So I have like a ton of hope in my kid, Eli, you know, that he is, and his colleagues and friends are going to come together, and, you know, that they're going to go into the nonprofit sector and they're going to be super engaged in technology and innovation. And a lot of the things that we have been arguing for and fighting for in terms of trying to, you know, raise the awareness of the potential of technology out there, like it's going to be actualized by this generation coming up.
You know, Sam, one of the things that makes me feel less like a crazy person when I am in online spaces with you is kind of bolted into that concept that you're talking about. And that is, let's take a step back for a minute and look at ecosystem-wide inefficiencies. And I have very much been a proponent of ecosystem-wide inefficiency solving for the last 5 years of my work. But, you know, to Tim's point, there's no bad actors, but there are sort of bad systems, right? So I've been in spaces where I'm like, can we solve inefficiencies in the ecosystem? And the answer always comes down, as long as it supports our marketing, or as long as it supports our ACV in the next quarter. And those two things actually do run perpendicular to each other, because it's the time horizon embedded in both that makes those things competitive to each other. My follow-up is, one of the big things that you have raised is that innovation itself is actually a quest for transparency. Right? I mean, even if you look at something like blockchain transactions, for example, what does that do? That makes everything wholly transparent, demarcable, and democratized. And I think that transparency of action is something that has been sought after in all of these spaces, right? Technology platforms, philanthropy. You know, what are the things that drive that transparency in your observation?
Yeah, it's such a great question, Tracy. Like, you know, if you take a big step back and you think about philanthropy in general and like why we're all part of this, you know, we're all, I think, we all have this vision for making like a genuine impact in society and like trying to solve some of these like really big challenges that exist. And so, in terms of, I think the biggest challenge is that like we still see so many individual foundations or even individual nonprofits that are trying to like change that system on their own, right? And there has traditionally been this reluctance to share data, like starting with foundations and even nonprofits that are out there trying to achieve their own mission. It's like they have this sort of walled environment where they're doing work and they're accumulating a lot of really important data. But when it comes to like sharing that data, it has been like pulling teeth for a lot of organizations. And I'm with you, Tim. Like, I don't think there's any bad actors out there either, but I think that like we have legal departments that like start to get nervous about like sharing data and some of this transparency. And I think we also have a lot of grant makers that have traditionally been very nervous about sharing data when it reveals that the work was not successful, right? Like there's lessons to be learned that are super important, but not all philanthropic projects are successful out there. And when they're not, I think many, many grant makers feel like, well, we haven't stewarded this endowment of ours in a very good way if the project did not achieve the success that we hoped that it would. And so for all of these reasons, you know, philanthropy has been like this sort of walled environment when it comes to sharing data. So I think the very first thing that we have to recognize is if we really want to change the system or even understand what the system is, we got to start figuring out ways of aggregating all of this collective data, right? And we have to change our mindset. We have to start going out of our way to like, you know, take this data that we're all accumulating and get it in the hands of other people, let other people start to analyze it, right? Like I've always had this sort of dream in philanthropy that we can start to collectively get our data aggregated and then like turn the data scientists of the world loose on it. And let's see what kinds of like interesting insights they can derive. Like I want people outside of philanthropy actively looking at our data and bringing diversity and a whole new perspective into this sort of walled ecosystem that we've built over the years. And so it's got to start with the funders. It needs to trickle down to all of the nonprofits. And then like all of the tech vendors out there have to come together as well and start thinking about like interoperability and common data models and facilitating all of this data sharing that I'm advocating for.
I am so glad you said that. Sorry, Tim, okay. Do you want to go? Because this is my little soapbox.
Yeah, it is yours, and I will let you at it in just a second. I just want to say,
yeah, go for it.
I hear what you're saying in, you know, Woodrow Rosenbaum from Giving Tuesday and yep. Tim Sarantonio, and you know the work that we've been doing around Common Data Model. Kate Ruff. I mean, this is getting echoed. But it does feel like just going to this issue here, nobody funds ecosystem innovation, you know, like, so I think that is a block right there. Like who's going to actually say, like, if we water the ecosystem with some funding, actually some new things can happen, but the actors can't act on their own, without that. And so, I think that's just. I think that's an interesting. It's an interesting dilemma, and I'm curious what will come next from it. But Tracy, floor is yours.
Oh no, I don't have that. Yeah, I do have a lot to add, but I'm going to try and be darn succinct about it.
That was just sprayed water out my nose. That was awesome.
Well, for our listeners, why Sam's here is because finally. I was in a meeting or something online, and Sam put a quote in front of a lot of people. And by the way, a lot of like tech industry executives were in that room. And Sam's quote was very simply, data platforms need to stop thinking of their data models as a competitive advantage. And that to me gets to the heart of everything you were just talking about, Sam, and everything that I personally have tried to care about a lot in public forums for like the past 3 years. And that is, it finally hit me that the blocker here is every single time some institution that serves nonprofits behaves exactly as it should in the current system of things, we actually make the nonprofit ecosystem technology less efficient. And the only way to break out of that is to start treating nonprofit data as a public good. And the thing that I've started saying is, you know, this is, I looked into the history of electrification in the United States, and this is where electricity was in 1920. There were regional distributors, all different voltages, all different AC/DC current models. And eventually Congress stepped in the late 30s and said, enough is enough. Electricity is a public good. It needs its own standards so that the innovation doesn't happen in distribution. It happens once you plug something into the common good that we're distributing. And so my actual question for you, Sam, is what gets folks to that table on the technology platform side? Because right now there's no incentive other than to participate in the same systems that perpetuate these meta inefficiencies.
Yeah, it's such a good question. You know, I guess instinctually, I feel like the push is going to have to come from the people who are buying the technology. And for the most part, that's like this ecosystem of funders, you know, which is private philanthropy and corporate philanthropy. Like, it's a really big ecosystem out there. There's a ton of money that's going into, like, you know, all of this software. But if the people buying the software aren't the ones that are saying, we demand more interoperability, we demand more common data so that we can achieve these goals of transparency and data sharing, then it's a pretty tough sell. Like, you'll continue to see technology companies that are very, I think, nervous about losing whatever competitive advantage they have or believe that they have, sort of based on their own models. But, you know, I think a lot of the players out there have been looking to find ways to work together more efficiently. Like, there have been a lot of partnerships between a lot of the technology players in the nonprofit sector. And so, you know, again, to your point, Tim, I feel like in a big way, like, everyone's heart is in the right place and we're all still trying to figure this out. And we saw so much change happen last year. And with these movements like trust-based philanthropy and participatory grant making, everybody's looking to streamline things. Like, I feel like, you know, the foundation is there at this point for tech companies to come together and start figuring out how to enable all of this transparency and interoperability. Hopefully it happens sooner rather than later, because I think so much hinges in terms of, like, the ultimate impact that we're going to be able to make.
So I was thinking about that, and that is very hopeful, and thanks for that. I mean, Tracy, I think your answer to the question, who funds ecosystem innovation, if we're taking the electric company example, is the government. And I don't think I've ever been so scared of getting an answer in my life on that. So I definitely.
Is that because, like, of that, Reagan's quote is, you know, I'm from the government and I'm here to help quote? Yeah, or is that rooted thing in Reaganomics, or is this New Deal 2.0?
I don't know. I'm from Montana. We don't trust the government. We think they're going to take our land and our guns up here. So I just grew up in those waters. So I think it's something. It's that. And also, you know, I don't know why I think that is. I think partly it's like trying to weed a garden with a backhoe if the government's involved. Like, you can't actually get at the root issues on that unless it's funded really precisely. And I would say, like, the government does not have a habit of funding things precisely, right? The bluntest instrument you can get is policy and you know, budget from the government. So, you know, that's a side pot. Like, I don't, that's not what you were intending to say. I hope that's not what you're intending to say, but it is interesting.
But I do and think also, policy does play a role, because we've tried every other vector. We've tried going to big tech companies and saying, please, sir, may I have some more? We've tried going to philanthropy and saying, please become a different beast than you are. We've tried going to nonprofits and saying, can we please build your capacity? And, you know, all of these things unto themselves, I feel like, to Sam's point, are, you know, you're sort of like in sort of a whirlpool, and what you're trying to do is get your way out with, like, one paddle. And, you know, this is pointing to a bigger, more collaborative endeavor that gets people rowing in the same direction. And that's a convening. That's not a let's keep doing the same stuff, right? And it's a convening with new actors in the room. And I don't know, like, yes, and is what I will say. I also have a very dubious kind of perspective on the role of government these days as well. But at the same time, policy applied judiciously can still support these kinds of outcomes. That's my hope.
And funding.
Funding, right.
Interestingly about that, what I've noticed post-pandemic is that the parallel threads, and this is especially true in Canada, is the government is recognizing the inefficiencies in its own ability to operate in, you know, inefficient ways with technology, and especially at work from home, by the time you're talking second secure cloud systems and all of that, like they found themselves in the same quandary that nonprofits were in. And you are seeing a dual flux of budget that is going both towards government efficiency and nonprofit efficiency on digital transformation. So I it's not quite as hopeless as I'm making it out to be there. And I think that that is true. The other thing though, that I wanted to say is that nonprofits are terrible consumers. Sam, that's the thing that makes me so nervous, is that the nonprofits that are good consumers are the ones that have this figured out, operate really like full functioning for-profit businesses that have got it dialed in. And that does not, that reflects like 5% of nonprofits in the US, and I'm sure it's actually even worse globally. And so the concern I have there is that, you know, nonprofits that are less than 5 million, maybe even less than 10 million, really sit in receiver mode on technology and wait for, you know, they look for the discounts and they look for free licensing, what they consider free licensing, even if it's
a really good point, Tim.
And so, you know, if the ones pushing back are these large, these biggest nonprofits, my concern is we're actually skewing the industry in, you know, towards an extreme minority of nonprofits. That makes me nervous. I don't think it's fixable. But well, I think the fix on that is, how do you make nonprofits better consumers, to Tracy's, you know, to something Tracy wrote earlier this year. But do you see the same thing? Is that, you know, you've seen a lot more of the kind of nonprofits that philanthropy funds. How does that land?
Yeah. You know, to me, I think, so like when I worked at the Walmart Foundation, like Walmart processes well over 100,000 grant applications a year. And it's because they are in, you know, more than like 4,000 communities around the United States and multiple countries around the world. And like, you know, what a lot of people don't know is that like every Walmart store, whether it's a Sam's Club or a neighborhood market or a Walmart Supercenter, they all have budget to make grants in their local communities. It's a really, you know, spectacular system. And so as a result, like I had the opportunity to really start getting a feel for like how many nonprofits are out there, and like, you know, forget 5 million, like a lot of them have like a budget of like 100,000 over the course of a year. So here's the thing, like if these nonprofits really want agency and they really want the ability to like have a voice in how things are done, they need to start figuring out ways to collaborate together and to work together and to speaking with one voice. And so I won't go so far as to say, like, I think there's too many nonprofits and they should, you know, merge together. I think there's, you know, that's a situation that's probably not going to happen. But I do feel like, you know, what happens when you get like, you know, here in Bentonville alone, there's probably, you know, half a dozen nonprofits focused on like hunger relief, you know, for K-12 schools. Like if they start speaking with one voice, then they increase their agency and they increase their power. And so we need to see much more of this like coming together and defining like some common goals and common missions and starting to speak with one voice. And then I also feel like, you know, you need to extend that onto the funders as well. Like nobody is changing the system all by themselves out there, whether it's the Gates Foundation, right? Or whether it is, you know, somebody that, you know, it is much, much smaller, like most of the other foundations out there. So we need to see these collaborations occurring like among nonprofits, among funders, among the constituencies, the recipients of these services that are out there. You know, it kind of speaks to the whole concept of like participatory grant making, where you bring together multiple, you know, disparate groups of people who are all interested in approaching a challenge together and who all benefit, I think, from the same change. When you bring all of those organizations and people together, like you're so much stronger. And so I think that whether it's like influencing you know, the technology and the interoperability and the common data models, or, you know, the outcomes that we're all hoping to achieve through the work that we're collectively doing, if we don't begin to see more of this collaboration and coming together and speaking with a common voice, you know, I think we're going to have very little chance of really affecting a significant change in the way that work gets done.
One follow-up question I have on that, Sam. Well, two really. One is, are you familiar with Leon Wilson's work over at the Cleveland Foundation?
Oh yeah, big Leon Wilson fan.
Yeah, us too. We had him on our series in the past year. And I feel like a great example of that collaboration is how the Cleveland Foundation itself responded to COVID-19, and his sort of like work with community organizations and the board of the foundation to try in new ways to distribute funds equitably in response to the pandemic. So that is, for our listeners, Leon's also like a huge tech historian, and I am aghast at the kinds of knowledge he holds about like what happened in the tech industry, particularly before I came online, which was like the mid 80s. And so therefore my other question to you, Sam, is if what we need is better convening and collaboration, how do we do that in a neutral space? Because I feel like, to Tim's earlier point, like I know Microsoft Tech for Social Impact enough to know that their intentions on the common data model for nonprofits are pure. They really want to change the industry. And the blocker there is other tech platforms will look at them and be like, well, this is just Microsoft's way of cornering market share and oh well. But you know, so you have this sort of purity of intent that's blocked by the nature of the beast. How do we get this convening in a way that folks can feel like that neutral space is real?
Yeah. I have had this soapbox for a number of years, and that soapbox is that the nonprofit sector needs technology to help it create a better sense of community out there, right? We really need like a technology, you know, ecosystem that facilitates much, much greater collaboration and convening and this sense of, you know, having the ability for people to discover one another and to find like-minded and like-hearted people and organizations, and to connect nonprofits with funders who have common missions, and to enable funders to discover nonprofits that may have traditionally been overlooked. You know, I think that that's sort of like job one right now for technology is like, I don't know that I have like a roadmap or a blueprint for how we go about creating this, this ecosystem, but it feels like that is kind of the foundation for like all of the other things that we keep talking about, right? If we really want to see, you know, a sea change in philanthropy and the way that impact is achieved, we've got to make it much easier for organizations to come together, to discover one another, to work together. You know, and I'll say, I think there's a lot of onus on the technology vendors, like from, you know, Microsoft and Salesforce all the way down to, you know, to my own organization, Submittable. We all have to start figuring out ways to like create this sort of interoperable environment for organizations and people, you know, including constituents, to come together.
Yeah, Kate Daniels introduced us to the idea of there being a competitive room and a collaborative room in, you know, in this ecosystem. And I think that that is right. Even boots on the ground, you know, the organizations that you're talking about that are local, you know, they all have their own brands to cover and, you know, funds to raise, and that's in the competitive space. But you're highlighting again the need for there to be we have more power with one voice here, and you know, and I think that those kinds of moves are scary because capitalism has really like set so firmly in our mind that competition is so real and that to break rank is like sudden death. And so I think that if there's a place that can happen, it is in the nonprofit space. It's the social impact space, and you know, ESG is opening the door on what that even means in pretty substantial ways. But yeah, I think that you're right that that there has to be a collaborative space, and that space has to really be about impact. And I think you and I know, like, organizations are groups of individuals. All of those individuals have their own hopes, dreams, things that they care about, passions. And, you know, so a brand's not a brand. Microsoft isn't just Microsoft, as large as it is. You know, that is actually led by the direction of people. And so, there are definitely pockets of hope inside of all of those platforms. And I think that that's really important to know. Like, there actually is kind of behind the scenes, there's a lot of that collaboration that happens. It's just so informal. It'd be interesting to see what that looks like. And I don't know what it is either, but it would be interesting to see what that platform looks like, where there's just a higher amount of transparency and collaboration.
Well, Sam, is this really a discussion about values in some ways? And why I bring this up is because I had the privilege very recently to connect with the folks who were bringing HubSpot's nonprofit service program online. And I am not going to tell their story, but what I will say is, during the course of our discussion, the values of movements like Black Lives Matter came up substantially. And I know for me, as a white person, as a queer person, you know, it is almost relieving to say Black Lives Matter. Because what I know to be embedded in that is that if we center our values on that, we will actually create a movement where that rising tide lifts all boats. And I feel like one of the discussions we haven't had with any of these entities is a discussion of how do we center on new values. Is that crazy?
No, I don't think it's crazy at all. You know, I think even like from a consumer standpoint, like, consumers are beginning to make buying decisions based on values as much as they are, you know, price. And a lot of like corporate, you know, grant makers are beginning to come to this realization that, like, that's a pretty major aspect of their corporate social responsibility practices within their organization, is that they have to start responding to this sort of like newfound emphasis on values. And I agree with everything you're saying, Tracy. Like, to me, values are super important. I feel like, you know, a major role of technology in general is to allow people to live out their values, you know, to like facilitate their values, and that software should be very values-based. You know, which sounds kind of funny. Like, if you build a grants management system, like, how does a grants management system equate back to like an organization's values? You know, well, it does. Like, it, you know, like, if one of your values is transparency, then your technology should, you know, facilitate a lot of data transparency. So totally agree with you. Like, you know, I think in the grand scheme, like, I think there's a lot of other work that can happen, at least alongside this like emergence of values, you know, as a way to define like the new technology and how technology can affect change. Like, you know, one thing I would go back to, Tim, to an earlier point of yours, is when it comes to nonprofits, like, nonprofits need to start thinking in a much more innovative way as well. And there are some nonprofits out there that are beginning to think more like for-profits, and they're thinking about like revenue streams. You know, and I would go so far as to say, like, I think Candid is a really good example of a nonprofit organization that is starting to think like in ways beyond just like asking for grants, right? Like, how do we go about like generating our own revenue out there, so that I'm not so dependent on all of these nonprofit organizations, and then I don't have to hope that their values align with my values for me to be able to do my work. And it's a really different way of thinking for nonprofit organizations, but I hope that more of them do. And I think, like, back to our earlier discussion around like collaboration, you know, they gain much more agency when they begin to work together and to centralize around a common set of values. And they also start thinking more outside of the box in terms of, how can I get my work done and achieve this mission without having to rely so much on the traditional funding process?
I'm glad to have, I think that that's so right about innovation and about nonprofits thinking of themselves with a business model. And I think whenever I'm thinking about that, and I know that you know this, but I always put this plug out there that the economics of those two realities makes this a completely different industry. And it's all about the profit. So, you know, the economics of a for-profit business are do as little as you can for the highest price you can charge. And in the nonprofit world, it's completely backwards. Do as much as you can for as little as possible. And so my point on that is, yes, nonprofits need to think about their revenue streams, and they need to think with the same aptitude, you know, and fiscal responsibility and planning that for-profit businesses do. But we have to understand that when they're done, they will not have the leftovers that for-profit businesses have, unless they start to create some of those revenue streams specifically for that end. And I think that's a great model. We just have to have it in our mind, and especially boards. And this is just such a sticking point for me. What worked for, you know, board members in their businesses that were successful, which is why they're on the board, they can't just do a one-to-one transfer on what worked for them over to the nonprofits that they serve. And I think that just gets missed. That just means that innovation funding doesn't come from all the leftovers on margin that have happened in previous, you know, the previous work that they've done, which again goes back to, okay, how do we fund it?
Yeah. And to take that one step further, like, if you think about the nonprofit sector, like whether it's nonprofits doing the work or whether it's funders, like we are notorious laggards when it comes to innovation. I mean, we just over the last 5 years have been, you know, so excited to see, like, you know, much of our technology stack moving to the cloud. And like the cloud has been around, you know, since, you know, I don't know. To me, it feels like the beginning of time, but it's, you know, the private sector moved to the cloud, you know, a decade and a half ago, and we're you know, finally getting there. And so I think that if I were a nonprofit organization right now and I were looking to change this whole paradigm, I would start, you know, getting 100% all in on emerging technologies right now. Like if you want to start getting funders excited about innovation, then start talking, you know, about innovation the same way that the private sector is. So, you know, it's, I just put out a newsletter recently that said, like, if you're not thinking about things like crypto and DeFi and blockchain and NFTs, like, you know, you are already behind. You may be too far behind at this point if you're not already thinking about how these things impact your organization. And so, you know, it's a shift, I think, that a lot of nonprofits are going to have to make is like, stop waiting for the private sector to tell you when it's safe to adopt a new technology. Like, get in there and be in the trenches with the for-profit organizations and with the people who are, you know, early adopters of this new and emerging technology, and start thinking about how this can revolutionize the way that you achieve your mission. And that's how you get funders excited. And that's how you get funders to start to change their processes. And that's how you get funders to start to give you general operating dollars where you can go off and do research and development and develop the nonprofit infrastructure and technology infrastructure that you have to have in place to do all of this work to begin with.
Well, yeah, I love what you're saying about that. And yeah. I just saw someone named Sherry Quam Taylor, who I haven't been following, but am now on LinkedIn, refer to how we think about Charity Water as this, you know, big success. And we want, you know, in terms of innovation, like they're very innovative. The way that they work is efficient and they have great systems. And her point is we look at that and look at the outcome and skip the middle part, the whole chasm of risk that got them there. So when we're looking at innovation, we need to just cross the word off and say risk over and over and start training us to say, like, we are going to actually start to fail. And, you know, the fail fast model of innovation for technology is probably what needs to happen, but philanthropy also needs to be up for that. They, you know, and to your earlier point about seeing
that's right,
seeing failure in philanthropy is actually okay and important. If you're not doing enough failure, then really, are you trying enough new things? It just feels like that wraps around into itself as well when we're thinking of innovation.
I literally, Tim, like that was where I was wanting to drive this, was what creates that safe space to have those discussions from a philanthropic perspective as related to the power and privilege they hold over nonprofits? Because, I mean, we did back in 2015 an entire one-day workshop on failure at the N10 conference and dissecting failure, discussing it, articulating it, and yet it still gets swept under the rug in 2021, you know? So how do we create that safe space, Sam, in the philanthropic world to talk about risk and failure in the way that, frankly, if you're not doing that in the corporate world, you're not doing your job?
Yeah, I love that question. To me, I think philanthropy, including funders and nonprofits, have really sort of like missed the boat a little bit on this sort of intense focus on impact that we all collectively have. So we spend so much time and energy and money and work like trying to change a system. And that's our definition of like making a real impact, is that we've actually changed a system. But to me, I think it's extremely difficult to change a system, you know, like doing this on our, even doing it collectively. Like I mentioned earlier, like the amount of money that was spent last year in philanthropy compared to like how much the US government spent. And so to me, I think the real role of philanthropy is to innovate and to experiment and to figure out like learnings, like what works and what doesn't work. And if we have an idea of something that works, then let's start bringing in other partners. Like let's bring in the government. As much as you distrust them, Tim. And I think I'm from Arkansas. I'm a little distrustful myself, but like, you know, you got to start bringing in these partners that can take these ideas and scale them. And so we can't continually think about like the definition of being a good steward of the money of the endowment is only seeing success in these like projects that we're executing. We need to change the paradigm so that we're spending our money to learn things, right? And that we take those learnings and we say, hey, I think this can scale. And then we bring people in who could really help it scale. Like we're not scaling here in philanthropy. It's just, there's just not enough here. Like 500 billion feels like a, you know, a huge amount of money to somebody like me. But when you're trying to like solve, you know, huge issues in the world, it's just not enough. So I think the best thing that we can do is to like stop acting like everything has to be so safe, that we have to always see success, that our work always has to translate into like these, like, you know, very specific outputs and outcomes. Like, you know, we need to continue to help individuals and help organizations and help society. But if we start to rethink this whole paradigm and we begin to experiment and we begin to innovate and we bring others in that can help scale these solutions, like that's where the real change occurs. And I think, you know, that's a lot more fun for me. I'd much rather spend my time, you know, on innovation and experimentation and finding partners that can help me take what I think is a solution and really bring it to scale.
Yeah. And you just touched on something that's very close to my heart as well. I mean, the way you said this when we were sort of framing out this conversation before we hit record is, don't get so hung up on impact, because right, that's not the real destination. The real destination is after that. That's, you know, and, but the thing that's also close to my heart in what you said is, I think a lot about the career paths of someone like myself who 20 years ago figured out how a fax machine worked and had a fight with my CEO about why we're not getting the cheapest computer on earth to replace the broken cheapest computer on earth. And that began my career in technology. I think one of the issues that blocks us is that issue of retention and that issue of churn that happens. And, you know, what I love about what you said is, if we recenter on everything that you just discussed, what I see is the elevation of a lot of people's career paths and the elevation of their futures with organizations, so that there isn't the like, I set all this stuff up and a year later I'm gone. It's like, no, I set all this stuff up and now we're going to grow together. That would be amazing.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, it's even as recently as a few years ago, I think, like people would question, like, why do you want to work in the nonprofit sector? And, you know, it was a legitimate question, because as a technologist, you know, like today we're starting to embrace the cloud. Like I was doing that 15 years ago in the private sector. we really have to help the whole organization make this like a shift to not being laggards and to being much more, you know, on the front end of the curve for innovation. And I think that that will help to bring really interesting, diverse, skilled talent into the nonprofit sector, and it will help retain those people. Right. And without that, like, you know, it doesn't matter how much money there is, and it doesn't matter how much the whole paradigm changes, and it doesn't matter how much power changes, if we don't start bringing in like more and more people who could work anywhere that they want to, if we can't get that level of talent in the nonprofit sector, then it's sort of all for naught. And, you know, how in the world will we ever retain, you know, people like you, Tracy, if we can't make it interesting and make it fun and, you know, really give you an incentive to be part of this sector versus, you know, working for a huge corporation that has the budget to do some fun stuff.
Sam, thank you so much for this conversation. Thank you for your work. Where I know that we're going to have listeners that want to follow what you're up to. What are some of the best ways to follow your work?
That's fantastic. Thank you for asking. So definitely like connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm Sam Kaplan. /Sam Kaplan. I'm easy to find there. If you go to the Submittable website, you will come across a couple of my projects there. One is called Impact Audio, which is a podcast where I get to sit in the Tim and Tracy seat and interview some interesting people in the nonprofit sector. I also do a newsletter every couple of weeks called The Review that you can subscribe to. So I hope that everybody out there has enjoyed the conversation as much as I have, and definitely please feel free to connect with me, and let's talk about how we can change this sector and make technology interesting together.
Thank you, Sam, so much for your time. I think this was an incredibly engrossing and, you know, tip of the iceberg discussion for what needs to happen next.
Well, you're most welcome. Thank you for having me as a guest. And, you know, I hope as we all emerge from our COVID cocoons that we get to be in the same place at the same time in front of a whiteboard, and we will solve the world's problems together, Tracy and Tim.
Can't wait.
That'll be fun. Awesome. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Tim Lockie.
I'm Tracy Kronczak, and you've been listening to Why It Matters.
Why It Matters is a thought leadership project of Now It Matters, a strategic services firm offering advising and guiding to nonprofit and social impact organizations.
If you like what you've heard, please subscribe, check out our playlists, and visit us at nowitmatters.com to learn more about us.